Good morning. I don't think many of us necessarily believe in hell, but it's said that if a hell did exist, that the devil would force the inhabitants of hell to dig holes and then fill them back up again, and dig another hole and fill it back up again. And that would be go on for all eternity. Well, just as the case may be, maybe a few of us here experienced just a little bit of hell. Well, not really, because we were good friends. We were going to plant a tree next to Reverend Carter's gravesite yesterday, and we dug a hole in this hard clay, and we got down about 3 feet wide. And Penny Shore was one of those people who had to get a truck and bring this large tree. It's out front now. And with that, somebody from Springfield Township Grounds Department came up and very nicely told us, well, that grave spot where you think you can plant a tree is owned by somebody, so you can't put a tree there. And they did not think there would be any location suitable for putting a tree that can grow and the roots can expand. So they said we could probably donate trees later, sometime later this year, where they're going to line the driveway there with trees and repave the drive. And this tree that we purchased will be planted somewhere on our grounds. But I thought it was quite funny. We had a wonderful crew, Sally Ann Killian, Betsy Anderson, Patty and Brandon Weirs, myself, Mandy Bly. Quite a few people were here, and I thought it was funny. We did all that work to dig a hole, and then we had to fill it back up again. So it wasn't really hell. My message theme this month is entitled The Beloved Church. And in my message last Sunday on radical hospitality, I told one of the parables that Jesus used to teach about hospitality. And I don't offer stories, such stories, because I believe they're from God or that they offer any unique wisdom. Instead, I occasionally use them in messages because many are so effective in teaching universal ideals of goodness. And I used a Jesus story last week about a man hosting a banquet to emphasize the spiritual reasons for being hospitable. Showing radical hospitality to all is one of the three ways that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. believed is how we create a worldwide beloved community. And it has relevance to us as we want to create a beloved church. Now, another Jesus story, as told in the Bible book of Matthew, says that there was a very, very wealthy young man who approached Jesus and asked him what he must do to go to heaven. Now, as a Jewish man, Jesus replied that this rich young man should follow the teachings of the Torah. And the rich guy asked, which ones? Now, that question annoyed Jesus. Ideals in the Torah like don't kill or don't steal or love your neighbor, Jesus said, those aren't ranked from most to least important. Follow them all, Jesus said. Well, the rich guy asked or said, what else must I do? And Jesus then likely looked at him intently and read this young guy like a book. Here was a snotty, full of himself, rich young man who thought money could buy him anything he wanted. And so Jesus knew what would be almost impossible for the guy to do. Go and give all of your money to the poor, and then come follow my teachings, Jesus told him. And this rich young guy looked shocked. And he turned around and slowly walked away. He loved his money too much. And Jesus followed up this encounter immediately with one of his most famous statements. It is more difficult for a rich man to enter heaven, he said, than it is for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle, end quote. Now, for centuries, and still today, that statement confounds and deeply frightens wealthy Christians. And they take little comfort in what Jesus said immediately after that statement. With humans, that's impossible for a camel to pass through an eye of a needle. But with God, everything is possible. And so Jesus was implying with this encounter with this wealthy young man that wealth brings many dangers. People are prone to rely on money as the source of happiness and security. Instead of prioritizing love and goodwill in the world, many wealthy people believe money buys them contentment. And Jesus instead knew that well-being comes from serving and giving and showing compassion. Those are the things that even some wealthy people do practice. So they are difficult to adopt, but not impossible. And I relate this Jesus story because it colorfully teaches what is truly valuable, I believe, in life and death. Being great is not about being rich or powerful. It's not even about building human equality, which Martin Luther King said only creates stagnant sameness instead of constructive oneness. We must build a form of heaven on earth, Dr. King said. One where we don't just tolerate one another, we honestly love one another. People must therefore build a worldwide beloved community comprising the entire one human family. Now, there are three things, and I related these last week, but I'll repeat them, that Dr. King believed prevent such a beloved community from being created. And those are, one, exclusivism, number two, materialism, and number three, militarism. And I addressed the antidote to exclusivism last week with radical hospitality. And next week, I'll discuss the opposite of militarism, nonviolence, which was one of Dr. King's priorities for a beloved community. But today, I suggest the antidote to materialism is obviously a humble attitude towards wealth. In other words, it's a gift to be simple. Money and things are not the problem. Those are just objects with no value other than what we assign to them. Instead, it's the way people think about money and things that needs to be continually checked and changed. There's no world religion that condemns money itself, nor do any of the world religions condemn wealthy people. Instead, it's the selfish obsession with money and things that work against any beloved community. Arrogance, greed, and the over-appreciation of luxury are what most world religions say is truly evil. What is it that a beloved church like us values? Is it our building, our budget, salaries to staff, the amounts that are donated every year? Or is money simply a tool by which a beloved church serves and loves and enlightens and grows people? Now, much like Jesus taught, Jewish people encourage a love of people over money. They believe all people are made in the image of God, of Yahweh. And so every person, Jewish people believe, has innate dignity. And of course, that's one of the seven principles of Unitarian Universalism. Everybody, according to the Jewish people, should have sufficient food, clothing, housing, and health care, precisely because they carry the image and dignity of Yahweh, or God, within them. And Jews believe it is selfishness that causes some people to see money as their own, instead of as a resource for the common good. Rabbis, many Jewish rabbis, sometimes tell in their Sabbath services the story of a man in a rowboat. who suddenly, out in the middle of the lake or the ocean, begins to drill a hole beneath his seat. And others in the boat are upset and loudly demand that he stop this. "Why should you care?" the man asks. "I'm only drilling under my seat." And of course, the point the rabbis are making is clear. A self-focused attitude is destructive not only to the individual, but to everyone. It threatens the dignity of all humanity. Now, Islam, not surprisingly, teaches the same ethic. Muhammad and his wife Aisha were practitioners of voluntary poverty. A person can be rich, Muhammad taught, but he or she can and should renounce the benefits of wealth by living as simply as possible. Muslims agree with Jews that wealth and resources belong to everyone. And so Muslims are to substantially share the wealth they hold with the poor, not out of any charity, but because most of the wealth is not theirs anyway to keep. This voluntary frugality, so that all may benefit from money and wealth, is an often overlooked principle of Islam. Muslim imams tell a story of two equally pious friends who die and go to paradise. And at the entrance to paradise, however, Allah invites one of the men to immediately come in, welcomes him with open arms. But the other man, Allah tells him he must wait. And when that man asks why he must wait and his friend gets to immediately enter paradise, Allah tells him it's because his friend only owned one shirt in life, while he had owned two. In Buddhism teaches about money in very similar ways. Rich people are not bad, and neither is money. Instead, Buddhism says that it's the attachment, what other religions might say the love, but Buddhism says it's the attachment to money or food or sex or any other pleasure that's the real problem. Attachments cause people to worry that they will lose their prized possession, and those fears then create anxiety and a lack of peace. Someone can be rich as long as they have learned not to be attached to money or things. To let go of wealth, the rich should see it as something to alleviate the suffering of others, Buddhists believe. Being generous is a way to both prevent attachment and also do good. And there's a Sufi Islam story that teaches, I'm telling lots of stories this morning, a Sufi Islam story that teaches this universal ethic. A man and his family are fearfully walking through a large forest that's known to harbor thieves. And the son is tasked with carrying the family's bag of gold because it's very heavy. The boy is the strongest one also to fight off any robbers. And when they come to a fork in the path, the son asks his father, "Which way should we go?" The father stops to think and then tells his son to put down the bag and leave it at the fork in the path. By doing so, he realizes and he tells his son and his family that whichever path they might choose, if they're not carrying the bag of gold, they'll then be free of burdens and fears. And the lesson is clear. Money and things often cause a lack of peace. Now, as a quick aside, despite the sometimes arrogant claim by most religions that theirs is the only legitimate one, the truth is that most religions, as I've just pointed out about wealth, are similar in what they believe. Who's Christ or Yahweh or Allah or Buddha or the Hindu Brahman? But the same source of truth. They each represent a fundamental ethic. When we practice love towards everyone, and not just for ourselves, we find truth and contentment. And so that confirms the point I want to make today. A beloved community envisioned by Dr. Martin Luther King is a holistic one, a type of utopia where everyone lives cooperatively and at peace. As Dr. King once said, quote, "We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers and profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people," he said, "the giant triplets of racism or materialism or militarism are incapable of being conquered," end quote. So while there are many people who love others and not money, including many of you in this congregation, there are several very wealthy people who I believe are outsized role models of that ethic. Charles Feeney is a man who's an Irish-American businessman who started the worldwide duty-free shops. Over the last 30 years, however, he has given away nearly all of his $8 billion fortune that he amassed because of these shops to organizations that promote world peace and improve health care for the poor. At the age of 84, he's now almost penniless, and he promises to die a pauper. And J.K. Rowling, who many of you know is the author of the Harry Potter books, she was once worth over $1 billion, an English woman wealthier than the Queen. And she, too, is committed to giving almost all of her wealth away. She's equally a big believer in paying taxes. That's an unusual attitude to have. But she believes they are another way to care for the needy. And finally, another surprising person, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. He's surprisingly a person who's decided to give almost all of his money away. He and his wife, 2 years ago at the birth of their daughter, pledged to give 99% of their wealth away to charity. He lives relatively simply, wearing, as you've seen in pictures of him, jeans and hoodies, and he often takes his family and eats at McDonald's. He says, quote, "I really want to clear my life so that I have to make as few decisions as possible about anything, except how to best serve the community," end quote. He's trying to live the title of my message today. It's a gift to be simple. And these super rich people are, I think, indeed role models. Sadly, however, well-off people are statistically, the least generous of any demographic. The wealthiest 20% of Americans, those making over $200,000 or more a year, donate on average 1.3% of their incomes to charity. The bottom 20% of Americans, however, those making $30,000 or less, donate over twice as much, averaging 3.2% of their incomes. As Jesus and other spiritual prophets understood, wealth can often lead one to depend on it and hold on to it as a source of well-being, instead of using it as a tool to practice, as I said earlier, compassion, or to be humble, or to care for charities and people. Attitudes that Jesus said, and I think most of us believe, offer true and real and lasting contentment. As a practical matter, I suggest this church and all of us as individuals try as much as possible to practice simplicity in our lives and do the opposite by practicing generosity towards those in need. We do that to intentionally build a beloved community here and, of course, in the outside world. And as I indicated earlier, every world religion teaches those same principles about money and people. It's not money that is the root of all evil. It is the love of money that is the source of negativity in our world. Of course, as we know from commentators about racism, like Ta-Nehisi Coates, the author of the book we read about a year and a half ago, discrimination is rooted in the economic exploitation of one group of people for the benefit of another. And that's true, I think, of sexism and male attitudes towards women, and problems like climate change or violence or corruption or poverty or even physical or mental diseases. I believe those are all indirectly caused by greed and humanity's love of money. And toward that end, I suggest we as a church community and we as individuals make an intentional pledge to continue using our money and resources efficiently and with simplicity. And I believe we already try and do that to a great extent at the Gallery of Northern Hills. But I also suggest we must continue to be vigilant about it and intentionally, as I said, have our board and each of us pledge to examine our budgets in that regard. That means reducing our use of resources as much as possible. Electricity, paper, food, water. We can resolve, perhaps, to set our thermostats a few degrees lower in the winter or higher in the summer. We ought to use digital media as much as possible instead of print media to save on paper and printing costs. Might limit buying packaged processed foods for our health, but also for the benefit of our environment. Purchase local produce in our lives here at church and ourselves, and then practice, reduce, reuse, recycle. We can encourage carpooling and fuel-efficient vehicles. And we might use volunteer labor whenever possible to maintain our building. That's an efficient use of our resources, precisely so we can give more away. As I said, simplicity means for our board and all of us to examine our budget, to be sure expenses meet our criteria, to focus as much as possible on, yes, meeting our basic needs, but also so that we can be generous. And every expense must be subject to that examination. And I would say even my salary is not immune from that examination. As a congregation, we can be on the lookout for any waste, inefficiency, or improper spending. And all of this is not so that we can continue to save up and amass more money or wealth. It's thereby to continue our desire to be a beloved community, not only for each other, but for the outside world. To aspire to the sublime heights of a beloved community, I encourage us then to regularly meditate on how that's expressed in everything we do and say. Martin Luther King, echoing the teachings of Jesus, had obviously done that kind of deep thinking. Genuine love obviously aches at the bigotry and exclusion that we can see in the world. And it yearns for radical hospitality and radical inclusivity we talked about last week. Genuine love rejects the selfish use of money, and it thrills at the charity and generosity we see in the world. And genuine love, as we'll discuss next week, is always, always nonviolent in speech and in action. And so I encourage you and me together to deeply, deeply ponder these truths. And I wish you much peace and joy.